Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2013. Lecture 26, delivered on May 2, 2013. The title of this lecture is Review for the Final Exam.
Today, review for the final exam. Yes, this is the end of our happy story together. It was a dream, and it's coming to an end. Okay, now. Here we go. First of all, and I'm going to just give you the broad outline of what I want you to know for it, and then you can ask me questions. Essentially, as an overview, take those two exams that I've already given you, put them together, throw out the easy stuff, and you've got my final. Well, that was helpful, wasn't it? Yeah. Part one, multiple guess or choice. You know what I mean. It will be 30 questions. Yeah, 30. Is there a freaking echo in here? 30 questions, and each of the let me be specific. About half to two-thirds of them, I just pull them right off the exams one and two, copy, paste, and then maybe rearrange the answers. And then another block of them are basically the same questions but with different numbers. You know, some of the multiple choice had were like numerical calculation. Like there was one that was about break-even, there was one about NPV, that kind of stuff. All those kinds, they'll be on there, the same question but with just different numbers. And then perhaps maybe a fourth of them would be new questions, but most of them on old material. There should be two to three on the last lecture, the economics of wreckage. But other than that, it is stuff you've seen before. Like I said, half to two-thirds of them are exactly what you've seen, and then another block of them, you've seen them, just different numbers. Am I hearing music? Is that... never mind. Okay, and then, like I said, and then you go down the list a few extras on that last lecture of mine, and a few new questions on old material. Part two, workout. Now, I'll put up narratives, just a narrative, a couple of things you might want to know, want to use. For example, you saw in the last narrative I had a problem. I didn't tell you what I was asking about, but clearly it was a marginal cost of capital problem. On the first exam, you saw information that would probably be useful to get ratios and to do volatility analysis. Yeah, that'll be there. You're going to get two questions. I'll post them on Monday night for you to work on, figure out, well, what could he ask from this? I won't tell you what I'm going to ask, but it's pretty obvious usually. So that would probably indicate to you, oh, well, there will be a marginal cost of capital question, probably some ratio analysis. There will also be volatility, find your sales volatility, sales risk, business risk, contribution of operating leverage, contribution of financial leverage, just what I asked before. There is nothing on this final in part two that you have not been asked to do on exam one or exam two. In other words, you will be asked to find the price of a bond. You'll quote a bond. Well, you'll quote the bond. You'll find a yield to maturity, a yield to call. You'll probably, not probably, I would expect that you can find a loan payment. That's something that you would find quite useful in your actual lives when you go out there and you start working at McDonald's, buy a trailer. Find the price of a share of stock. Now remember, I usually ask, give you information that is for the purpose of applying the capital asset pricing model. And then from the capital asset pricing model, you get your discount rate, which gets you part of what you need for the formula for the price of a stock. You've done it. On the last exam, on the first exam, you weren't all that great. On the second exam, I did it again, and you were getting it down like a boss. So I would imagine that you'll all ace that, and of course ace the entire final, or not. I'm going to ask you for some, I already said this, but just to make sure, I'm going to ask you for some financial ratios. And also operating DOL, DFL, DCL. Unless I'm mistaken, that's it. I've just told you everything about the second part two of the exam, except the answers. So if you bomb that part of the exam, well, you deserve to go over and major in English. Now, as far as that first part, let me just be a little more specific, and you can ask me questions as you wish to. But in that first part of the exam, I certainly expect you to know about the Federal Reserve, how it works, the kinds of money. Remember, barter, commodity, and fiat. Also, the different measurements of money. M1, M2, M3. Don't forget there was also an M0. Do you remember M0, what M0 is? It's hardly ever talked about, but it's actually kind of an interesting thing. It's just pure cash and currency. It's what's called the base metric. And then M1 is M0 with demand deposits and traveler's checks. And then M2... is M1 with small-time deposits, negotiable order of withdrawal accounts. And then M3 is M2 with the massive, insanely large time deposits and the euro dollars. Now, that would be something that I could ask you about. Which one was growing at what rate? One of them was growing at a rate of about 0% from the period 2004 to 2008. Which one was that? That was M1. The money we used, they weren't growing it, even though the economy was growing and needed more. One of them was M2 was the one that was growing. It was beginning to tail up, but it was growing at a rate of about 5%, growing faster than the rate of the real growth rate of the economy. And then the insane one was just, its growth rate was accelerating, was M3. And that was because of, for the most part, well, there were a couple of reasons. And the big thing M3 was growing for was the fact that we were buying all these imports, and as we bought them, we exported American dollars to pay for them to the central banks of other economies, China, Canada, the Arab countries. We buy oil from Japan, India. They were essentially that our dollars were accumulating in their foreign reserves, which was why M3 was on this path, and it was almost uncontrollable. It's even darker than that. There's something else that's been growing, and it's almost impossible to measure. We've got sort of a lower bound on it and an upper bound, but we can't say much about how much it is. This shadowy money that is being put offshore in places that we can't tax it, we can't even know exactly how much it is. And the measures... we know the lower bound is about $2 trillion. The upper bound is about $32 trillion. Where it really is, probably closer to the upper bound, in the upper $20 trillion in money that is there. It's not even measurable. We can't even get our hands on it. We can't tax it. We don't know exactly where it is, what it does. But that money's out there too, and that's not even an M3, and that's growing unbelievably fast. But I wouldn't ask you about that. I just mentioned that as a side point here. Okay, now also, like I said, know about the operation of the Federal Reserve. I would certainly also expect you to know some of the details of what's the difference between monetary and fiscal policy, who controls which and what. What are the three jobs of the Fed? What is beta measure? Find the yield in multiple choices where, if you remember, I asked you to find the yield on a discount T-bill. You know, if you buy the T-bill for $950, what is the yield on it? That was from the first, excuse me, exam. Know the difference between the different types of markets in terms of capital versus money markets. Remember, capital markets are the long-term markets. If you were raising money through a stock offering, you'd be touching the capital markets. But if you were trying to raise money just to get through your big buildup of inventory season, that would be the money markets, the short-term markets. Also, know the difference between the primary markets and the secondary markets. Primary markets are the markets that where companies sell their securities out into the open or to private investors and bring money into the company. The secondary markets are the markets where investors buy and sell the securities among each other, among themselves. The company does not directly benefit from anything that happens in those markets, although the company obviously wants to see to it that the prices of its stock stay high in those markets, because that way when they sell their stock in primary in offerings, they're getting a decent price for it. But they don't have anything directly to do with the secondary markets. Know the difference between the Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities Act of 1934. The Securities Exchange Act of 1934. The Securities Act of 1933 has mostly to do with offerings of securities by companies. How you do it, when you can do it, all the requirements that you have to meet for your filings with the federal government, with the SEC. The Securities Exchange Act of 1934 addresses the secondary markets, how they are supposed to behave. Trading, insider trading is in the 34 Act. When does a company that's trying to buy the stock of another company have to report that it's acquiring stock through just the secondary markets? It can buy a certain amount without telling anybody. We're slowly just kind of calling brokers and buying into this company. But there's a point where it triggers. It can't do that anymore. It has to actually announce that, oh, we are seeking a significant position in equity in this company. Also, the 34 Act would deal with things like restricted stock. If the stock isn't registered, how do you get it so that you can sell it freely tradable? Know the different kinds of exemptions. The Reg D's. 504 is the $1 million offering that creates freely tradable stock. It's an exemption for small companies. The 505 and the 506, they're private placements aimed at sophisticated investors. The stock is not freely tradable. Same is true for Reg A, up to $5 million. Exempt from all of the jumps and hoops of the 33 Act, but still, the stock that people buy, they can't just sell it. It's restricted under Rule 144. And that's what we call it, Rule 144 stock, or restricted stock, or something like that. Make sure you know about the S-1. An S-1 would be a full-blown public offering, not necessarily an IPO. Companies sell stock more than once in their lifetime. And also remember the term I use, shelf registration. When a company registers a big, huge amount of stock, but it doesn't sell it to the public all at once. It sells it as it needs to, but it's got it all pre-registered. Know the difference between the, in terms of debt, who is the buyer of debt and who is the seller of debt, the issuer. Remember, when you borrow money, you are actually the issuer, the seller of a debt instrument. The buyer is the entity that lends you the money. Know the difference between a bill, a note, and a bond. Some economics concepts that are important. What is the cost of the best foregone alternative? Do you know?
Hey.
Oh, I love it when you talk dirty like that. Dinner, tonight, okay, Denny's. Seriously, wear that little black number. Animal. Okay. Where the hell was I? I forgot what I was talking about. I was thinking about that black little number. What was I talking about? Oh, opportunity cost, yes. Okay. Money you've already spent. Do you know what that is? What? Sunk, yes. It's gone. It is irrelevant to decision making now. Remember what I said. Once you've spent that money, it is with Jesus. It is gone forever. The only time you'll see it is if you go to heaven, and we know you ain't going to see that money again, are you? No. You see, that's sunk. And then there are other kinds of money that we talk about too. But important. Also, historical cost versus replacement cost. Historical cost versus replacement cost. Now, this actually is, I told you that story about someone sitting in who owned a gas station. Should he charge the prevailing price or should he charge based upon what he paid for the gas? But this actually can bite you real hard in so many different situations when you have to decide how you're going to charge for the stuff that you are selling based upon historical cost or on what is called a cost to replace. That's something that you have to think about when you buy insurance. When you are looking at your any kind of a property policy whatsoever, and I look at this speaking in my own business, am I being insured for what I paid for my equipment, or am I being insured for what it will cost me to repurchase that equipment? I mean, that can be a big difference. So that concept of historical versus replacement cost is real, and it's in almost anyone's face if you have any kind of insurance that covers property. Are they going to cover what you paid for it, or are they going to cost what it costs to replace that kind of stuff? This is especially true, interestingly enough, in the world of high-end art. You might buy something at a low price, but if that thing is appreciated in value and it's destroyed, you are not going to get that thing back at its historical cost. You're going to have to find out if you got insured for the replacement cost. Usually in that section in the multiple choice, I ask you to find me a net present value. And an internal rate of return. I might, in the multiple choice also this time, which is something I didn't do before, I might ask you for something like the future value or the present value of an annuity. Watch it, whether it is an annuity due or an ordinary annuity, for God's sake, because that could burn you otherwise. I want to restrict these sections to what you have already seen for the most part. You'll have a little bit of new material, but for the most part, it's all what you have done before. And what I'm trying to do is have you show me at the end that you got it so that you can go on with your lives. And I don't have to worry about where you are, what you're doing, are you eating right, are you using the toilet regularly. Know about the risk structure of interest rates and the multiple choice, but you also need to know that as something that would be worth knowing for the essay questions too.
Can you read that?
Know the risk structure. First of all, know what the risk-free rate is, what it means, and what its components are. Then know the risk structure of an interest rate. There's the default premium, the maturity premium, and the liquidity premium. I would anticipate moving now, sliding you over into the essay section, I would anticipate that you could give me an example of something that would have one of those interest, one component, but not the other components. So, for example, is there an interest... Give me an example of an instrument that would have no risk premium at all. What would that be? Can you give it?
T-bill.
Bingo. Exactly. Could you give me one that has has only the maturity premium? No default premium, no illiquidity premium. Could you give me one of those? Yeah? Not a T-bill. T-bill has none. But a treasury bond would have a maturity premium because it's a long instrument, so it's subject to interest rate fluctuations. So it's a T-bond that would have the maturity premium. But it's not going to default, and you can sell it like hotcakes. So it's got no default premium, no illiquidity premium. Which one would have a higher default premium? Credit card debt or a student loan? In other words, which one would have a pad of interest rate in it that was bigger for default possibility? Would it be a credit card interest rate or a student loan interest rate? Credit card. Because a student loan has a relatively low default rate, no one wants to default on a student loan because they'll send a SWAT team and shoot your ass. How about a car loan? Would it have a high default premium or a low default premium?
Low.
Because what's the main reason? Bingo. It has something that could be taken back. Even if you default, something can be recovered. Not everything, because as soon as you drive a car off the lot, you know, it loses a lot of its value, but something can be pulled back. Home loans also have very low default premiums for two reasons. One is there is the asset itself, which can be seized, but also, as I told you before, people don't know it, they're paying an insurance premium for the bank in case you do default. So even if you default, the bank has got the house, and the mortgage insurance company pays off the balance. So the crocodile tears about, well, look how horrible it was for the banks the way everyone was defaulting. They were doing well on this because they were made whole, and then they had an asset that they could get off their books. Some of them had a hard time doing it because they sucked at selling, but there you go. Okay, that's enough about that. Let me go on for some questions. And you've seen these questions before, most of them, or I've talked about them. Some of the ones that I brought up that you didn't see on the exam, this time you might. And some of them that I've asked before, I'm going to ask you again. quite possibly either one, because it's such a core concept, or two, because you were terrible on your first answer, so you got a chance. So let me give you a couple. What do I mean by the residual equity has the residual claim on the cash flows of a firm? What do I mean by the statement that equity or the stockholders have the residual claim on the cash flow of a firm? What does beta measure? Distinguish between systematic and non-systematic risk. I could word it distinguish between diversifiable and non-diversifiable risk. What are the three roles of the Federal Reserve? Explain an open market operation to contract the money supply. Again, explain an open market operation to contract the money supply. What is the relationship between risk and return? What is the relationship between risk and return? What is the relationship between the price of a bond and the yield on the bond? Again, what is the relationship between the price of a bond and the yield on the bond? What is meant by optimal capital structure? What is meant by optimal capital structure? What factors cause earnings volatility to be greater than sales volatility? What factors cause earnings volatility to be greater than sales volatility? What are two reasons debt is a lower cost component of capital structure than equity? What are two reasons that debt is a lower cost component of capital structure than equity? In the presence of significant long-term tax cuts, how did the federal government finance growing operations during the period from 2001 to 2007? In the presence of significant long-term tax cuts, how did the government finance its operations, growing operations, in the period from 2001 to 2007. Another one I could ask on that. Compare and contrast the revenues and expenditures during the period from 1993 to 2001 with those from 2001 to 2007. Again, compare and contrast the tax of the revenues and expenditures of the government in the period from 1993 through 2001 with those from 2001 through 2007. In other words, compare and contrast the surpluses and or deficits in those two periods. What was the relationship? That's enough. You got questions for me? Ask me. Yeah. Okay, it is, I'm giving you 7, you answer 5. Okay? 7, I'll give you 7 and you choose 5 to answer out of the 7. That'll actually make it a little easier for you because then you can see 2 that you don't even know about. Other questions you have? Yeah. Oh, I will be in my office on Monday and Tuesday of next week from 1:30 to 3:30. As far as anything else goes, I think that's all I have for you today. I thank you for being my students.